Hey, welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm your host, Howie Jacobson. Quick reminder that the new book is out. You Can Change Other People, The 4 Steps to Help Your Colleagues, Employees, Even Family Up Their Game. This is a business book, but it's also a personal book. I wrote it from my experience as a coach, helping people change entrenched self-sabotaging behaviors. And I put all my knowledge and all of Peter Bregman, my co-author's knowledge, into a book to help you do the same thing with the people that you care about in your life. So it's available right now. It is for sale wherever books are sold. You know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookstore.org, your local independent bookshop, my personal preference, if you can do that. And I would love for you to get a copy. That is one amazing way to support me, is to help the sales of the book, and to read it and implement it. And if you like, go on Amazon or somewhere and leave a review. All right, so let's get to today's episode. All right, this is going to be a brief introduction to today's episode because today's the 2nd of March, and I received a very nice email from my publisher reminding me that the manuscript is due on March 14th and asking how everything's going, how's the writing going, do you think you'll still be able to get it in by that due date? And I said, of course, everything's going great. And then I proceeded to cry and bang my head against the desk and then started writing again. So I'm going to keep this quick. The episode is one that I recorded with Glenn Murphy at the end of last week. He kind of wanted to talk about how to not be an asshole. And very quickly, the conversation got around to the book that I'm writing with my coach mentor, Peter Bregman. And the title of the book is You Can Change Other People. And the premise is that when people are struggling around us, we want to help. And we either make things worse by criticizing, giving advice, or we just empathize with them and collude and saying, oh, yeah, you poor thing, those other people are such jerks, and we're not particularly helpful. Or we just, you know, follow the wisdom that says, look, you can't change other people, you can only change yourself. And since both Peter and I have been coaching for him for almost 30 years and me for 20, we know that that's not true. You absolutely can change other people for the better, to help them be happier, to help them be more effective, to help them achieve goals, to improve your life if they're doing things that are getting in your way or annoying you, or just people that it hurts you to see them struggling. So we wrote a book together, or we are writing a book together. In 2 weeks, we will have written a book together, and I'll let you know more about it as we get closer to publication date. But in the meantime, Glenn and I ended up talking about this process that we share, that Peter and I share in the book. And actually, not the whole process, it's 4 steps, and we basically cover half of the first step. But I think it's the foundation, it's still incredibly valuable stuff. I want to make clear that the ideas that I am sharing in this podcast, if it sounds like they're all coming straight out of my head, it's largely Peter's work and our work together in turning it into a process. So I want to make sure that Peter gets full credit for anything that you listen to here that comes out of my mouth that you think, hey, that's pretty good. Glenn Murphy, as always, is thoughtful, challenging, and a great raconteur and a great listener, and as well as being sort of my stress coach and martial arts instructor. So he brings his own unique perspective to it. And we also talk more generally. At the end, I ask him about, well, what about just, you know, being out in the world and seeing all these things that annoy you and people that are doing things that you think are wrong or stupid or hateful. And you don't really want to change them, but you just, you know, have to respond in some way. And so we talked about his perspective from a martial arts and a stress management perspective, how to just deal with negativity and unpleasantness in your life. So it's all about how to be helpful and how not to be an asshole. And so I bring you our conversation.
Howie, how are you, pal?
I'm good, Glenn. Good to see your face.
Yeah, likewise. Actually, well, I mean, seeing it through the medium of Zoom again, we're still not hanging out, but you take what you can get these days.
Right. Well, I was listening to that Esther Perel video you sent me about different ways that people can connect now and the cost and what we could, how we can make up for it. So I'm very appreciative of this.
Yeah, definitely. She's a deeply underrated, I think, Esther Perel. For those of you who've never come across her, she works in the realm mostly of like relationship and sex psychology and stuff like that. But just she uses those as a window on human experience as a whole, and just a deeply, deeply intelligent person. Just one of those people that you listen to and you're like, wow, how could you help wrap your head around this many different things and just keep them all front of mind and like all of the time? It's kind of awe-inspiring to me.
It's especially these days, I'm finding like I'm gl really glomming on to people whom I find kind and generous and interesting. Like more than, because I have so much less contact with that sort of thing in flesh and blood day to day. So I'm, since it's really since you turned me on to Tyson, I've been finding more and more people are like, oh, well, that sounds like Tyson too, and oh, that's another perspective, and oh, that's so cool, and just we've talked about like it's really hard to be sort of kind and generous and positive a lot of the time, and so when I find someone, I'm like, Marty McFly in Back to the Future, like grabbing onto the tail truck with my little skateboard. So I'm gonna follow them.
Nice, timely analogy. We just watched all those movies with my 8-year-old son. I've been just giving him the full 80s movie education, and he absolutely loved Back to the Future. It's funny, some of the things just don't translate all that well, and they're just really dated. But and you would think Back to the Future is very dated, right? Because it has us in the future of 2015 wearing like inflatable Nikes and flying around on hoverboards, which hasn't quite materialized. But it's but it holds up really well just as a story. Like 8-year-olds apparently still think it's as awesome as I did when I was 8.
Pro tip, if it's not too late, do not show him Risky Business.
Oh, okay, got it. Yeah, I wasn't planning on that for like another 6 years or so, but yeah, noted.
I made that mistake with Mike. This is a really funny movie.
Never mind. Forgot about the dark undertones there. Yeah, things go. Nice. Oh, okay. So on the subject of trying to be better people and trying to learn from better people, right? I think a lot is being made at the moment, especially in the midst of the pandemic and everybody kind of struggling to find some meaning through it all and be like, we're going to learn from this adversity and we're going to become better people and grow, right? There's this big kind of personal development push of everybody trying to get you to be your best self and emerge from this even stronger than you were before. There's a counter argument, which I'm quite fond of actually, which is just like, it's a pandemic, cut yourself some slack, give yourself some grace, and just let's work on keeping ourselves on a baseline of kindness and generosity and things rather than just being, improving yourself through it all the time. If you can do the latter, great. I'm really interested in this kind of intersection between attempting to do better yourself, right? Or committing yourself to the intent of being a better person and improving yourself, self-development, whatever that means to you, however many of those books you've read in the Barnes and Noble entire section now that's devoted to that, and not being an asshole, right? So there's definitely a Venn diagram in which there's like a crossover area in the middle. And I'm very conscious of this, even as somebody who hosts a podcast and pontificates on the right and wrong ways to do things. I try not to say things are right or wrong, but we are talking in generalities about ways of doing things that might be suboptimal and ways that might help, right? So I run a podcast that talks about how to do better in terms of managing stress and your emotional state, how to maintain your body in a better state so that you don't do yourself damage or self-sabotage. You're constantly talking to people about how to manage lifestyle issues, how to not get sabotaged by modern society and forget about the benefit of plants and the benefit of plant-based diets and eating and just kind of exercise and just maintaining some sort of balance perspective in your life, which puts you in tune with the environment and the people around you, right? So we're both in the business of telling people how to do things sometimes, right? And there's definitely a risk of going beyond the helpful and the generous and the enthusiastic about your own developments and the own things that you feel that you want to pass on, and being an asshole, right? Just being so convinced that your way of doing things is the right way, whether that's you as a vegan, whether that's me as a Sistema instructor, right? Or what, do you know what I mean? Or anywhere in between. You know, it's like, yeah. Yeah, I'm told that vegans do that sometimes. I know that's a sweeping generalization, but
I was on a podcast with a vegan podcast a couple of weeks ago. And I was like, one of the things I've learned is like, I could be wrong. She's like, no, we're not wrong about being vegan. I said, well, yeah, I mean, I'm still behind it. I haven't found anything better, but like, I'm wrong. Like, I don't like just having that little, you know, molecule of humility.
Yeah.
But, it can be challenging for people when they don't want you to.
Yeah, I think it can. And I think therein lies one of the first things that I want to talk about. And that's, I think, the path to avoiding that side of the Venn diagram, right? Or venturing into the middle of it and being an asshole, partly lies in just making sure you know who it is that you're talking to and what their experience is, and just allowing the possibility that there's truth in their belief, however abhorrent or wrong you think it is, you know, from your objective viewpoint of reading a lot about it or acquiring years of experience and expertise. Do you know what I mean? So there's some reason why you think you're right and the other person's not quite right, right? Or you're more evolved than them or something like that. And if you come to it only with that viewpoint, it all but guarantees that you'll be an asshole at some point, I think, right? Whether you're talking about martial arts and like what's the best way to fight somebody, whether you're talking about, you know, diet and what's the best diet for you, what's the best exercise plan, you know, what's the best way to deal with stress, right? So for example, I run these, you know, workshops, very effective, stress-proof online courses now as well, you know, multi-week courses where I'm facilitating and talking to people. And I work with people from different backgrounds and roles, right? And it's very different when you're talking to somebody who has an average 9-to-5 job and you're telling them about, you know, you should really try to batch your tasks, like emailing into smaller bits so that you don't frame switch all the time and cause stress in your nervous system because you're constantly flicking between different roles and things that you should be doing. You should try and introduce little movement snacks into the day so you're not sitting still for 8 hours a day and your limbic system thinks you're hiding from something, right? You should try to make some time for breath work and make some time for movement, which will help to modulate this kind of buildup of chronic stress in your body. So there's all these general things I can give people. And then I'm talking to like a 911 call center operator who's forced to sit still for 12 hours a day that can't leave their desk in case somebody dies, right? When they're called back again and faces very different challenges. Or maybe they even work shifts and they, you know, they don't get to protect their perfect sleep schedule because they do 4 days on, 4 days off. And some days they're working from, you know, midnight until 6 in the morning or something like that, you know? So you have to be very aware of somebody's individual experience before you start prescribing a one size fits all formula to what's the best thing for them. And maybe the same thing applies, I don't know, when you're giving people advice in diet, right? I'm sure you have general guidelines and principles of things that will help people, but do you come to it first with like, where are you at and what are your challenges?
Well, that's the challenge of writing a book, is that you can't know, right? So you bomb it from on high and you try to be as useful and kind as possible, but really the rubber meets the road in coaching where, you know, and I've taught probably 100 basically vegans how to be coaches. And the hardest part is we don't know the answer, right? Because we don't know, first of all, what they're eating, what their life is like, who else is in their family, what their ethics are, and what's going to be better for them, right? Like it takes a tremendous amount of humility to let your client kind of lead, and we're just kind of helping them run experiments to figure out what serves their best interests. So absolutely, like coaching for me is one of the blessings of learning that skill set, is it kind of forces me to be humble and it forces me to be empathetic at a really deep level. Because you can tell it's exactly like Sistema in terms of you can feel my resistance, right? And we were trying to do a drill, a pushing drill or pulling or something. The minute I resist, you can tell. And the minute you have resistance that's not efficient motion, you can, you know, it's
you can tell. Yeah.
And you can tell for yourself, like, oh, I'm holding here.
Yeah. Right?
Need to, you know, relax the hips. I need to breathe out. I need to do something. And coaching is the same way. The minute there is, I have an agenda above and beyond my client, there's that glitch. They're going to, you know, they're going to be mostly polite about it because they're good people and they're kind. And but there's going to be that resistance. It's like, oh, now I don't, now it's hard. Now I'm not sure what to do. In the same way that when I'm trying to grapple you and it's not working, my instinct is to go harder.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. As that's so you have to come at it, first of all, from this openness, right? You have to come in with an openness to want to kind of listen first. And then prescribe, if at all, right? And that's definitely easier in coaching because you have a pre-made dialogue. That's what it's based on. You agree to do that as the coach and coachee, right? From the beginning, you're like, here's how this works. I'm not going to tell you everything to do. I'm going to listen to you. We're going to figure out solutions together. And that's what we do as a coach, whether it's a diet coach, exercise coach, stress coach, a martial arts coach, right? That we're all kind of doing the same thing to an extent. Do you ever come across this, though, just to play devil's advocate, right? That people sometimes are just waiting for you to tell them something to do, right? And if you don't give them the framework, and if you're like, hey, let's figure out solutions together, like the therapist, you know, you go to talk to a therapist about your problems and they're like, what do you think's the problem? I'm like, I'm kind of paying you $200 an hour to figure out what my problem is. And you start talking about things, you're like, blah, 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 blah. And you get to the end of a few hours. I'm reliably informed anyway, this is how it goes a lot of the time. And then at the end of it, you're like, what did they do besides listen? And then maybe after an hour and a half, like prod, like a one size fits all kind of Zen koan into my head so that I could contemplate my own problem. You know, all they really did was help me steer my own problem. Do you find that there's frustration sometimes where people are like, look, just give me the framework and then we can talk about the exact thing we've got?
Yeah, no, I give advice all the time.
Mm.
The trick is to give advice and offer them the opportunity to respond to it, right? Mm. Like, well, I have something's coming up for me. I want to throw this out and see what you think. Or here's I have an idea about what you could do here. Would you like to hear it?
Mm.
Right? Like as long as they are in control,
mm-hmm.
they will not resist. You can say, you know, and sometimes the best thing is when they say, no, that would never work.
Mm.
Now we've got something to work with.
Now you got some meat.
Cool. Yeah. Why wouldn't that work? What about that wouldn't work?
Mm.
Now you're like, okay, so now they hear themselves talk and they say, you know, very often at that point they go, oh, well, I could do it this way.
Mm.
Right? So the presumption is that other people are smart. And if they have really sticky problems, they've probably been wrestling them with them for a while, and some quick, easy, obvious solution that's obvious to you, they've already thought.
Mm.
So, you know, there's so many reasons as a coach to, like, you know, we're well educated, you and I, which means we have had thousands and thousands of opportunities to prove how smart we are.
Mm.
In classes, in tests, in examinations, defenses, mm-hmm. it gets to be a habit.
Mm.
And I think that's part of being an asshole, is having to prove how smart I am.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I'm not. Howie's like, you could have said that a little bit less enthusiastically. No. It's like, yeah, that's exactly the kind of it. No, I'm sorry. That was a very deep recognition of my own asshole tendency to do that as well. But in that, yes, just to clarify that way. Yeah, it definitely is. Yeah, and that's a definite root of it, right? And if you talk to people who train Sistema for a very long time, they'll fall back on the idea that it's just a basic pride problem, right? The more you identify with your own ego and your own pride, and the less you attempt to cultivate humility, right? The more you'll fall into that trap. But I think that's helpful to a point, right? As an aspiration, you can aspire to be more humble and you can aspire to exhibit less pride. But like you said, it's a habit, right? If you spend a lot of years building up and testing your knowledge, testing your experience, testing your ability to tell people, teach the people about things, you've built up a lot of years of that habit, and it's difficult to unlearn that. You can't just drop from that into pure humility. My cup is empty. Do you know what I mean? Like learner's mind, and now watch me learner's mind with you, right? It's very hard to drop from one to the other because there's stuff in there. There's stuff in there that thinks it's helpful, that it wants to come out. It wants to help people. It wants to give people advice, whether it's unsolicited or whether it's inappropriate or not. There's something in there. And it's not always from a place of crappy pride. Sometimes it's from a place of genuine intent to help people, but it's just misguided, right? It just comes out at the wrong time, right?
Well, that's actually the book that that Peter Bregman and I are writing right now.
So yeah, tell us a bit about that. So that's How to Change People, is it called?
Yeah, How to Change Other People.
Okay, so what's the premise? That you can't, and it's, the book is 2 pages long and that's it?
No, it's 300 pages, but it's mostly a journal. It's empty.
Okay.
Yeah, on the same shelf as like for women, how to understand men, and for men, how to understand women. And
just blank pages, 300 of them. Yeah. So what's the, without like giving away the farm, because it's not published yet, right? It's coming out in a little bit. Like what are a few of the little precepts that you've come up with? In what ways can you help people or help to change people for their own benefit without being that asshole?
Right. Well, the first thing is, if you, like when we want to change people, it's usually because we're upset in some way, right? Either they're being a dick to us in like, or they're, you know, a colleague isn't doing their work and we have to stay late, or at home someone is just being annoying. And I know that, you know, we don't do this, but our spouses are sometimes annoying.
Yeah, we're never annoying to our spouses. I have that unreliable evidence from Mia.
we get into arguments about child rearing, and we just like, you know, you're not being your best. And so we want to speak up. You know, our default is like, let's not say anything. So when we do say something, it's usually because, you know, the thermometer has gone to 9 or 10 and we're, you know, there's smoke coming out of our ears, or we're just really sad for them. See, it hurts me to see you treating yourself that way.
Like, yeah.
We have friends who, when we see, are not taking care of themselves.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, they're depressed and they're sad and they're not going out and they're not reaching out. And we, you know, and most of our urgency comes from a feeling like we have no control. Right? So the feeling of no control contributes to that. And when you feel like you have no control, you want to reach for the emotion of control, which is anger. When I'm angry, I feel powerful. Right? Or I'm disappointed. Like I'm good at disappointment. I'm good at passive aggressive anger. I'm really disappointed in how you're doing.
So what's the antidote for that? Do you just become more aware of that surfacing and just acknowledge that that's your tendency? And then,
well, I think it's most of our tendency at that point. So yeah, to acknowledge it, because if we don't acknowledge it, no, I'm fine. Right. Then we gaslight and it's obvious as hell anyway. But to acknowledge it and then to do not systema, but I guess jujitsu, where you feel like, what's the value? And this is something that Esther Perel was saying in that video you sent me, that every negative emotion is based on a positive value. Right? So I am upset at this behavior because I value X. I value your health. I value your happiness. I value collaboration. I value each of us. I value my boundaries. Right? So to turn that into a positive. And so the first thing you want to do is empathize with yourself. Yeah, I feel bad about this. I'm kind of pissed. I'm from a place of being pissed. I'm going to handle it poorly. I'm going to get the very resistance that I'm trying to avoid. And so, you know, I am not a bad person for wanting this, because here's a deep value of mine. So I think that's sort of step one.
That's really fascinating, because I see parallels in both paths of what I do, right? So on the systema front, just physically, just immediately, the admonition that my instructors have given me is just that you have to first feel yourself. You have to first feel what's going on in your body, whether it's tension, psychological tendencies, emotional content, whatever that is. Your orientation, you orient yourself first, right, to the world and to the environment and what's going on. You feel yourself, then you can feel the other person. Right. Only once you've oriented yourself and felt yourself, do you have the capacity to feel somebody else and what they're feeling or truly understand them. And in that case, it's physically, literally feel them, like where their body's tense and where they're falling, where they're aggressive, what it's going to be. And then, and only then, can you start to adjust us. Right. You change the whole system. Like, you recognize that you're both in this kind of feedback loop, and then you don't try and manipulate the other person, you manipulate the connection between the two of you in order to produce an outcome, right? And that's the way that systema looks at it. And interestingly, in stress psychology, you have similar kind of principles with self-regulation and co-regulation, as like Porges would talk about it, right? There is no point in attempting to co-regulate somebody, be like, oh, hey, I'm going to help you out by making soothing noises and changing the tone of my voice and using different facial expressions to try and trick you into being calm. if you're not self-regulated, if you're coming at it from a place of anger or irritation, and your overwhelming motivation is to get you to shut up and stop complaining, right? Instead of like to help you because I genuinely want to, because, you know, I care about you and all those things, right? Then you're going to come at it from the wrong place. You can only co-regulate somebody to the level that you've already self-regulated yourself, right? This is something I talk about in the stress proof course. So you have to do that work on yourself first. And only once you've done that, can you progress to phase two, which is co-regulating, which in a way is what you're talking about, right? And like getting somebody to helping somebody or getting someone to change is a form of co-regulation. You're just changing their behavior instead of their diet or their body or something, right?
Entirely. Like that's the note I just jotted down is about, you know, Porges and safety, polyvagal theory the next thing is like when you're regulated to a place where you feel, you know, positive towards yourself, you then work on empathy towards them. Mm. Like everybody does things for good reasons. Sometimes they do terrible things for good reasons.
Yeah.
But they're trying to accomplish something. And so, you know, I'm a big fan of the underlying philosophy of nonviolent communication of Marshall Rosenberg. Which is there's basic human needs, and almost every human activity is meant to achieve one of those basic valid human needs: connection, safety,
belonging.
Yeah, various. You know, they're all positive. And so, when I'm at my worst, I'm still trying in some tragic way to fill one of these positive basic needs.
Mm.
So look at the person who's doing those things. Why are they doing them? So, you know, if someone has a really bad habit, it's almost always a defense mechanism against feeling a state.
Mm.
Right. So I'm eating, I'm smoking, I'm watching, playing video games, I'm doing a lot of porn. It's all to, you know, kind of distract me from an underlying state that I don't want to experience.
Yeah.
That's, you know, yeah, no one wants to be in pain. No one wants to suffer.
Mm.
I get why you're doing that. And I'm not blaming you for it, or I don't think any less of you for it. I think there are ways that you could meet those needs of not being in pain that would be in your better interests.
That's great. That really ties in, interestingly, with that whole idea. I think it's Lisa Feldman Barrett who wrote the book about how emotions are made. Did you ever read that one?
I had about a 20-minute podcast interview with her, so I'm an expert.
You know everything. You've chatted, so it's fine. Yeah, the whole idea.
I didn't actually talk to her.
Oh, you listened to one. Sorry. Yeah, I thought you were. Yeah, just that whole idea that that emotions are constructed, like body states are constructed from a kind of soup of inputs, like physical sensations, and then comparing it with past experiences, how you felt when you experienced similar sensations in the past, and then overlaying it with this kind of prefrontal cortex rider on the elephant, like, what should we do about this? And it's all kind of mashed together, right? And you can pull out of that one concept all of psychotherapy, like all the psychoanalysis, and pretty much all of kind of embodied cognition, all kinds of things like that, right? But this idea that often when we get into a series of behaviors, whether it's like binge eating or like staying up all night instead of going to bed because you kind of feel nervous and anxious about the next day, or you think you're not going to sleep, so you just don't, or whatever it's going to be, that often we blame ourselves for those crappy behaviors. Like, I should do better. I should be a better person. I shouldn't be somebody who eats like a fat guy, right? Or I shouldn't be somebody who avoids exercise, right? You blame yourself and start to associate yourself with those behaviors for doing it. But sometimes what she calls it, I believe, is a brain-body budget deficit, right? It's like over time, you've been maintaining this kind of stress state, or you've been maintaining this imbalance that you don't like in some way, right? You've been damaged, traumatized for a while, or you've just been experiencing chronic stress, like because of your work or because of a family situation or whatever it is that pushes you into that state, then over time, maintaining that kind of yellow alert state and that constant sympathetic nervous system activation has a cost, right? It has an energy cost, and that creates like an allostatic load. It creates like a deficit in your energy levels. And a lot of these behaviors are just an attempt to rebalance that deficit, right? They're like, I'm going to binge eat sugary food because I'm just exhausted and I want to feel the hit of having energy for half an hour. Even if afterwards I kind of know it's going to slump again, I can always have another hit. I'm going to mainline coffee, like three espressos in a row, just so that I can get that same feeling of having energy because I'm on the deficit. Or to, at the end of the day, instead of you know, going, joining somebody and going for a walk outside or doing an exercise or a yoga program or something, you elect to sit still, do nothing, tune out and binge watch a Netflix series because your body is trying to conserve energy. It's like you're on zero. The tank is empty. You've been maintaining it just with your stress levels all day long. So what you need is a bunch of sugar and sit still and don't use any energy, right? And so those habits, when you look at them that way, they become not blameless, but understandable, right? That you don't blame yourself for them. You're like, this is my body's attempt to fix itself from the situation that it's found itself in, right? So that can take a lot of the kind of blame and the personal kind of morality out of it a little bit as well. So I just thought of that when you were saying it.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like, you know, a person living in poverty takes out a payday loan.
Right? Yeah.
Like, yeah, I don't have a choice. There's, if I want to survive, then this is the only thing I can do, even though I know it sucks.
Nice. So you've got step one, which is, which was to understand yourself, right? Was to understand where you're coming from and what your motivations are. And then you had step two, once you're on that platform, you can think about cultivating empathy or compassion for other people. Is there one beyond that?
Yeah. The next thing you want to do is get permission.
Right? Okay.
So to like, we don't, you know, nobody wants, so if people are struggling with something, they're going to feel some shame about it.
Mm.
Right? They're already not feeling so good. So if you just say, hey, can I help you with this? Hey, I notice X, I have some advice for you. Or
yeah.
Why don't you eat an apple instead of that donut right now? Like that's how I'm helpful.
It's staggering the visceral reaction that just gave me just hearing you say that. Do you know what I mean? I don't know, it's because knowing you're a plant-based advocate and a vegan and stuff like that, like, whenever a vegan tells me I should eat an apple instead of a donut, I'm like, I wasn't going to eat a donut, but now I am.
Only if it doesn't have an apple filling, though. Yeah,
it's like, make sure there's no five a day in there. I don't want to. I just want 100% artificial ingredients, just to spite you for saying that to me. So, right.
Yeah. And we all have that reaction. So to get around that, you know, the thing I recommend is empathy.
Mm.
Right? Looks like you're really, you know, say something that the person can agree with. It looks like you're really struggling to take care of yourself these days.
Mm-hmm.
That must be hard. Or,
yeah,
you know, it seems that, you know, this is all sort of Chris Voss.
Sure.
Right.
It seems like third person objective. I'm not saying it and you're not saying it, but from somebody on the outside, it might appear that you're having,
Yeah. You know, or, you know, very often we want to like, there's various scenarios in which we can intervene. One is the person is just complaining to us and they're not asking for a solution from us or trying to solve it. They're just pissed off. And
They're
just, you know, this is the classic, like complaining about somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so what I want to say is, well, you know, you're probably contributing just as much as they, right?
Yeah.
And we go, oh, that sounds really frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
So to empathize, not to accept their story or their view, because the minute you accept their story, you're useless.
Mm.
You know, your benefit in this conversation is that you have a separate perspective that's more generous than theirs about the situation. So, you know, you want to empathize with their feeling, with their experience of it.
Mm.
That must really infuriate you. Right. And then we're talking polyvagal safety.
Mm.
You and I are on the same team. I've validated your experience, if not your perspective or rubber stamped your strategy.
That's a key distinction there, I think, is that you can agree with somebody's perspective without, you can kind of validate somebody's experience and perspective and strategy without agreeing with all of it wholesale. You can be like, it's true that's frustrating. Right. I agree 100% that you're struggling, that it's true. And this is not a situation that you want to be in. We both believe that right now. Right. And that's where you start from. But as soon as you start going in with expressing how you disagree with the whole thing and like, or you, resent it, or do you know what I mean? You can kind of see when somebody's expressing contempt. They don't even need to tell you, right? You can see it in the eyelids. And I have a friend, Terry Vaughan, who teaches body language. He's a former, British SAS guy, really amazing. And he released a video last week just on, like, he goes, if you could recognize this one expression, facial expression, it will probably get you further in like relationships and business life than anything else. And that's the lowered eyelids of contempt. Like when somebody starts talking to you and you're like, oh, well, that's interesting. And then they do that thing while they're talking to you, just a little bit of lidding, you know, as they go through. And if you can recognize that expression, you don't need to be like a, you know, Tim Roth, lie to me, micro expressions expert to recognize that, just like, oh, they kind of despise me right now. And they just told me that and they can keep talking and they can keep doing things. And sometimes we recognize that and sometimes we don't, right? But I think it was a really valuable lesson. I thought it was a really good one. Yeah. Okay. So This is fascinating. I really like that you've got like a stepwise progression towards this, in the same way of, you know, attacking the problem of physical defense or stress. It's the same kind of thing. It's like, fix yourself, like understand your part first, then attempt to feel them, feel or understand them, right? Feel, understand what their situation is, what stresses are applying to them, why they fear this, why it makes them angry, what motivates them, and then attempt to make a connection, starting with like the validation. You kind of give them a little bit of feeling of safety and support. And then from there, you can start to suggest things, presumably, or steer them in directions that they might accept, instead of like just offering them something like a present or a hammer, right? And then hoping that they'll receive it in good spirits. Like, it help, does that then help them to understand that whatever it is that you say, even if it's misguided, frankly, or even if it comes out the wrong way, that you're doing it from a place of good intent, right? It helps them to assume good intent in you rather than all the other things they might assume coming into the conversation.
I think so, although it's still way too early to give advice.
Like, okay,
you,
cool.
You know, you create all that wonderful rapport and lose it in a second.
Okay, right? Yeah.
It's easier to, it takes a lot longer to build the relationship than to destroy it.
Gotcha. So are there steps beyond this? Am I leapfrogging from step one and two to 12? Is this my problem?
Oh, I mean, at this point, when you have empathized and they have taken it and they're like, yeah, that's right. Right. Another good Chris Vossism. Like, oh, I feel understood. Mm. There's a magic question that can turn it around. It's like, would you like some help thinking through this?
Hmm.
Like, that's the permission question, but you have to do all the other stuff first.
Mm. Okay. Right?
So
yeah.
It's not, or let me tell you what to do, or I have an idea. It's, would you like some help thinking through this? So I'm explicitly partnering. I'm not setting myself up as any kind of an expert.
Hmm. Okay, you're setting yourself up as a facilitator or somebody that's just going to help give an outside perspective so that they can figure out the problem, right?
Yeah, well, just I'm going to be your friend. You want to talk this through?
Hmm.
Right? When they say yes, then you can start going to work.
That's great. That's really quite powerful, I think, right there. Just that one question, you know, just getting around to, because they're completely within their rights at that point to say no, right? They have the power. You give them the power to say no in that instant, right? Like, would you like some help thinking through this? Like, not really, not from you. You know, they can do that at that point and they can walk away. But if they give you the yes, then that's it, right? Then you can build on that.
Right. The thing is, we're afraid of giving them that power, but they already have that power.
Mm.
We're hanging on to the illusion of any sort of power or control. We don't actually have it.
Mm.
Anyway, and the worst time is when you think you do, right? When it's your kid or an employee, someone where you have positional power and you're like, oh, I'm going to fix them because I have positional power.
Mm.
In nonviolent communication, Marshall Rosenberg has this saying, you can make them wish they had, but they'll make you wish you hadn't made them wish they had.
Yeah, I've definitely experienced that with my 4-year-old. Yeah. Probably as early as this morning, as recently as this morning. So yeah, definitely. Okay, so question on this one. What if you're getting stuck at step two, right? You think you've identified your own motivations that might lead you astray and might send you blundering into asshole territory, right? You realize that you've maybe come at it with a little bit of anger or a little bit of irritation, and you've kind of flattened that out and you've tried to kind of make clearer your intent, both to yourself right, before you start doing anything, and then to the other person. But you're really having trouble with the empathy part. Do you know what I mean? Like, you just cannot see how somebody gets to be 500 pounds. Do you know what I mean? Or you can't see how somebody gets to stress themselves out that much. Like, how can you back yourself into that kind of corner and just be so obsessed with money or work or something that you're willing to sacrifice everything else and your family and things? How do you get over the empathy hump if your experience of life is so completely different from theirs that you just find it extremely difficult to start empathizing?
Yeah, well, it's not just getting over the hump once. It's like when we're grappling, I have to remember to drop my shoulders every 3 seconds.
Mm.
Right? So it's not like, that's solved. Now, you know, throw whatever you want at me. My shoulders are good now. Right? So, yeah, at the base level, there are practices of empathy. And just like, you know, if I want to be able to hold my breath for 4 minutes, I can't just decide to do it one day. So that, you know, we can practice thinking about other people. I mean, you know, reading fiction for me is a great empathy thing. Watching certain types of TV or cinema where I see stories and I get the full picture. You know, I have an exercise where I look at anyone and I imagine them as a baby. Like, Donald Trump as a baby is adorable. And innocent. Mm-hmm.
And Was he though? Was he though? No, we'll get off of that. Probably snatching sweets from people. Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, no, I take your point on that one. There was a specific exercise that I came across recently. It was in some book on psychoanalysis or something, or on, you know, counseling tactics for people and things like that. And it was a really interesting thing. And it was to, like, literally, I don't know if you come across this one. Apparently it's quite an old one, but I don't know why it took me this long to find it. But it's when you're having trouble kind of putting yourself in somebody else's shoes, you literally put yourself in a room with two chairs in it, like literally two chairs, right? One, you sit in a chair and you put an empty chair opposite and you sit in one chair and you say, and you just start saying all the things to the person. Like, I do not understand how you can do this to yourself. Like, every day, you know that you don't do well when you eat these foods. You know that if you don't get enough sleep, that it makes you angry and you wake up moody and then you take it out on me and everybody else. You know that you have a weak spot when it comes to being criticized as a position of authority. And yet you put yourself in situations where that happens all the time, like you bully people and goad them to question your authority. And then you get angry and then somebody gets fired, right? Or whatever it's going to be, right? You know that you do these things and it irritates the hell out of me that you do that, right? It's like, I don't think you need to be doing that. You need to do better. So you get to say all the things that you're saying you shouldn't say to them. Do you know what I mean? Like, you just kind of get out of your system and you're like, blah, 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 blah. And you kind of say that and you're like, And in doing so, you're actually clarifying what you said in the first instance, like your half of this relationship and the place of anger or motivation, emotional motivation that's making you want to change the other person so much, right? Especially if it's not your job, right? And you're just taking it upon yourself to do it. So it clarifies that from one thing. But then the key part is that from there, you literally get up, walk to the other seat, turn around, sit down, and you answer questions on behalf of the other person. So if you're doing Donald Trump, you know, like you'd be like, it just really annoys the hell out of me that, you know, you don't seem to care about people. You're willing to trample the Constitution. You're willing to do this, do that, blah, blah, blah. Whatever you think of Donald Trump, right? These are the kinds of questions that I would ask him, right? But then Trump gets to sit there and you have to be him, right? You turn and you sit in the chair and you're like, plenty of people love me. Like, I don't know why you hate me so much. Plenty of people think I'm fine. And I'm not the only corrupt politician in America, right? There's plenty of others who are opportunists, who, you know, like, don't care for everybody all the time and just go for their product. Why are you singling me out for special treatment? You know, so he gets to kind of give his defense in a sense. And then you sit there, go back into your other seat and then not argue with him, but say like, OK, I accept that there are other corrupt people. There's other people and not everybody hates you. So why should I? And blah, 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 blah. And you're like, well, maybe it's because when you act like a con man or you act like in a way that seems callous, it reminds me of myself when I could be a bully. And I hate that. You know what I mean? Like, it triggers something. It reminds me of a time when I did that to somebody. And it's uncomfortable to me to watch you do it because it's in full view. Do you know what I mean? And then you go back and sit down. And then Trump's like, well, that's your problem, loser. Right. And then he leaves. And then you're sat there and you're like, okay, now, so I just owned my part in that anger and what's going on in that little circle. And I've also made it a lot clearer as to what I think the issues are, like, a lot clearer, not just all of the things, like, I can't stand you and your whole face and all of your behavior, right? But exactly what it is that needs to change, if at all, right? Kind of that way. And then that helps you to kind of come back to the conversation that you haven't even had yet. Like, you've already had it out a little bit. Do you know what I mean? Maybe this is not one that I'm completely naive for never having found it, but I think it's a really interesting, valuable exercise.
Yeah, no, I took notes. It might end up in the book.
Cool. Nice.
So, yeah, no, I think that's beautiful. Because it in, you know, just the physicality of moving to another chair and embodying another person is part of that exercise. It's part of doing your push-ups.
Yeah.
But the other thing I was thinking about, the empathy thing, is very often we have a long history of screwing this up with people, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if I'm trying to get someone to lose weight and I have done it poorly, I have to come in and own that.
Mm.
Before I can, I can't just pretend like, oh, I'm doing this new thing and it's going to work, and you're not going to have any residual resentment of the way you made you feel terrible for 300 times already.
Mm.
So to come out, so and doing that can be very hard because it makes us vulnerable. But the truth is, it's also, you know, it's true. If we, you know, we need to own things, it's a true thing we're saying. Hey, you know, I know I've been a dick about this in the past. I really want, you know, it's been really hard for me. I really care about you, and I've made things worse in a lot of ways, and I really apologize for that.
Hmm.
It might have to happen well in advance, you know, to sort of prove yourself. And that kind of vulnerability, and we can also, in the middle of a really good conversation, you can trigger me, and then I'll blurt out something stupid again. Like, oh, we're not making the progress I thought we were going to make, or you didn't say yes when I asked if you want to think this through, and then a zinger is going to come out of my mouth before I can stop it.
At
that point too, to own, oh, I'm really sorry. That was completely uncalled for and inappropriate, and I feel bad for having said it. Please accept my apology.
Yeah, that's hard to do, isn't it, in the moment, in the same way that it's hard not to react with tension or with reactivity to somebody else's stress state, you know, it's like, or violent state, you know. So it's very hard to be bigger than both of you, you know. We like to be strong enough to let that fall on you, you know, before you continue. It's a difficult, but it's a really valuable skill to cultivate, I think. It's like some of the best arguments I've ever had, if there can ever be said to be such a thing, are arguments. And I've literally, like, written notes to myself in the journal afterwards, like, always do this. Like, the point at which you back down, acknowledged your own part in things, restarted the conversation, and then it got to a really good place, and the person actually liked me at the end of it, right? It's like, always do this. And then about one in three, I don't, right? And and I forget to do it, and I read back through it, and it does it again. I write it in the journal. I'm like, I should remember to do that. It's like, at some point, it's going to stick. You know, maybe I just have to have an argument with a periodic review. So I have to have an argument today, tomorrow, then in 2 days, 4 days, 8 days. I think if I do that like 32 times, probably it will stick in my head, and I'll actually freaking get it through my dumb English-Irish skull. So.
There's a teaching in rabbinic Judaism that, you know, the line that's repeated the most often in the Bible and the Jewish Torah is, do not mistreat the stranger, for you are strangers in the land of Egypt. It's like 30 And the rabbis asked why. And they said, because that's the hardest one.
Nice. Yeah, that's really interesting. I realize we're wrapping up on time here, but it's coming to this conversation beforehand. And I really love how it's kind of surfed the waves of things. And it's revealed some really nice things about your book. So I'm really looking forward to reading your book now. So again, it's you and Peter Bregman. Is that right? The management consulting expert.
Yeah, he's let's say an executive coach, leadership. He works with leadership, leaders, leadership teams.
And yeah,
it's large. I mean, it's basically, it's his methodology. He was my coaching teacher back in 1999 and has been ever since. So, you know, I've been taking the methodology and applying it to personal stuff, to health, to habits. He's in the executive corporate sphere.
Yeah. I listened to his podcast. It's excellent. It's his Bregman Leadership podcast. It's really, really good. He goes way beyond just like business and leadership. He goes into deep issues of dealing with the self and how that, I love it. It's a good one.
Hey, you and he both podcasted Levels Health within a day of each other.
Oh, right. Cool.
So, yeah.
And that comes out in the summer or something like that, or later on in the year?
The book?
Yeah.
I think it's September 7th.
Okay.
the date, but you know, the manuscript's due in like 3 weeks, and
okay, so I'm keeping you from it right now. So
I'm very interested to see how that's going to happen.
We'll have to get you and Peter maybe on there, like, to talk about it when it comes out. I think that'd be really good, like, afterwards. So as part of your press junket, was going everywhere you can do Systema for Life along with ABC, you know.
So I wanted to ask you, so that, you know, so this part of the conversation has been about not being an asshole when you want to change other people.
Yeah.
There's other areas, and I know stories of you in conflict, using your skills to reduce conflict.
Mm.
So I wanted to kind of explore that before we go.
What things I have learned that have worked, either by experience or kind of distilled knowledge that I've learned from other people, that just seems to keep repeating itself again and again. And it's interesting that some of the things that you've said have kind of dovetailed with some of these kind of these few principles that you've got, right? And one of them, obviously enough, is similar to what you just said with the rabbinic, the Judaistic precept of, like, you know, treat strangers well, because you don't know when you're going to be a stranger. That idea. So, like, or biblically, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, right? And it's the golden rule. You see it throughout all of the world's, most of the monotheistic religions, at least, and a bunch of the other ones as well. It's just like, you don't know when it's going to be you, so you should treat other people like you would like to be treated, right? And I think that's a good precept, and it starts to get at the problem, in that at least it reminds you not to treat people meanly, because you don't want anyone to treat you meanly, right? To not give you the benefit of the doubt, just to bully you, to shout you down, to not listen to you. You don't want any of those things for yourself. Very few people do, unless they're submissive personalities who like to be spanked. I don't know, maybe. But most people don't, right? Most people don't like to be bullied or beaten into submission kind of that way, right? So you shouldn't do that to other people. That's a fairly fundamental thing. But I think wrapped in within that is, you actually have to understand how they want to be treated before you can do that. I think that something that's misleading about that admonition is that you might want to treat other people like you would treat yourself, but you could say something like, I don't want any government handouts. I don't need any government handouts. I want everything to be, you know, merit-based, and I just get what I deserve, right? But that doesn't really put you in the same mindset as somebody who's, you know, lower on the socioeconomic spectrum, has never had the same opportunities as you, and has the right in some ways to be treated differently because they didn't get the leg up. They didn't get the head start that you got. Do you know what I mean? So yeah, I want people to treat me fairly, but fair might mean something else if you're talking to somebody who's in a very different situation, right? Or they're discriminated against because of the color of their skin or where they came from or whatever it's going to be, right? Not want to get open that whole can of worms, but you have to understand who you're talking to before you can even think about how they would want to be treated, not just how you want to be. So I think if you get too wrapped up in that one phrase, you can be like, I'm going to treat everybody the way that I would treat me, right? And I think that's a mistake, because not everybody wants to be treated the way that you would treat yourself, right? And actually, we treat ourselves, you know, Systema practitioners, martial artists, as coaches, we can be really hard on ourselves, right? We can put ourselves through things that we wouldn't want to put other people through. So why would, you know, I can't start a coaching session on stress and be like, let's begin with 10 gallons of freezing water over the head and holding a push-up position for 15 minutes, right? That's not going to get us right. That's how I treat myself, but it's not how I want to treat other people, right? So there's a break there. So
my love language is arm bars.
Say again, sir.
My language is arm bars.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, so that's the first thing. So as a basic precept, it works. But then everything that you've said about understanding other people, putting yourself in their shoes and empathizing, is like the subtext of that. The second one is kind of be mindful, right? And just be mindful of yourself, like express mindfulness. And so just be aware of how you might be triggered by phrases or words, how you might, how your body is reacting in the moment, right? That on a cognitive level, we might be like, I need to steer this problem. I've been there before. I can talk to people. But just on a visceral level, your body might start to show signs of protecting itself or aggression or taking up space, you know, all of these kinds of things, which will set somebody else off. And if you're not aware of those changes to your breathing, to your physical structure, to the way that you're positioning yourself and holding yourself, you might send the wrong message. Your face is saying one thing and your entire body is saying something different. Like Chris Voss has talked a lot about this, right? And other people as well. So you have to make sure that your body is congruent with what it is that you want to express. So you start by relaxing on a deep level, and then you practice getting good at being mindful about your body, right? So you express mindfulness and you attempt to extend that mindfulness as much as possible to other things, right? You carry out your day maintaining mindfulness of how people are feeling, how you're coming off to other people, that kind of stuff, right? But again, there's a caveat to that. I think there's a point where you can go past that and mindfulness just becomes like a trope. You know, you spend all of your time trying to be perfectly mindful and stay in a perfect state all of the time. And then you irritate the crap out of people just being so alert, you know, in some way, right? You kind of make people, I know, edgy or something, or people, you annoy people by being super calm and guru-like in their presence all of the time. You know?
One of my distance meditation teachers is a guy named Adyashanti, and he talks about there is nothing less natural about somebody trying to eat mindfully.
Yeah, I've tried that one a few times. Yeah, yeah.
And what we're looking for is a natural state.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think you have to over practice it. I don't believe that you have to be mindful 24 hours of every single day, right? I think it's natural to slip in and out of things and to be reminded, you know, you can spend more time in that than less, and you can be jolted back into it by something and set up things to that end, but you don't want to oversubscribe. And then onto the third, which is don't be a fanatic about anything, right? And this is something that Vladimir says in Systema. It's something that neuroscience tells us most of the time, that if you come to a fervent belief that your way of doing things, whether it's dieting, whether it's stress relief, whether it's fighting, whether it's whatever it is that you're management, you know, whatever it is, if you think you've come upon the golden formula that works for everything, and you're fanatical about how much good it can do in the world, right? It doesn't matter whether you're subscribing to a religion or whether you're subscribing to like an economic system or whatever it's going to be. Taking anything to fanaticism is always bad, right? It doesn't matter what it is. You can absolutely guarantee you will ruin something, even the best of things, by being fanatical about it. So yeah, I think that's pretty much it. It's like, do unto others, but understand what other means, right? And don't otherize people too much as you do that. Stay mindful, but don't be a maniac, and don't be a fanatic about any of these things, right? You have to stay human throughout all of these interactions. And I think those three things can carry you a long way towards not being an asshole.
Beautiful. Yeah. And I find that something that's very trustworthy for me is how I'm feeling. Mm. Like, you know, being superior to someone else and angry, when I check in, when I get mindful about that, it doesn't feel so good.
Yeah.
As opposed to feeling connected, feeling generous, feeling grateful, feeling joyful, feeling useful.
Mm.
They're abiding.
Yeah.
In the same way that junk food isn't as filling, as satisfying as a great conversation or a cuddle.
Yeah.
I'd like to become aware of what's, you know, what's our real food.
What's truly nourishing to you. Yeah. Excellent. I'll leave it with that. I think that's a great closing thought. I've got nothing more to add.
So. All right. Well, thank you. This has been awesome. Thanks for helping me articulate some of the book. I kind of excited to go back and keep banging my head against the keys.
I hope so. It's a motivation point. All right, pal. Take care. See you next time.
All right. Hope you found that useful. If you did, and you're listening to this in the future, which you almost certainly are, at least from my perspective, you can look for that book. I'm not sure exactly when it's going to be on Amazon, but if you go search for either my name, and it's going to be Howie, so my old name, Howie Jacobson, PhD, or Peter Bregman, Bregman, and the book is called You Can Change Other People. So if you would give it a pre-order, that would be awesome. That really helps drive it to the heights of the Amazon algorithm so that other people can find it as well. And hopefully we can make a positive difference in the world. So let's see. In movement news, man, I'm actually getting kind of strong. I'm, you know, doing these 5-day-a-week monkey bar gym workouts. And I swear, yesterday in the bathroom, I caught a glimpse of a bicep. It was like, oh my goodness, look at that. So I'm feeling pretty good. My back is definitely getting better. I'm starting to increase range of motion. And I'm going to get some special bespoke exercises to do to increase both mobility and strength, and also to start correcting some misalignments that have plagued me since I was a wee lad, as Glenn might say. And in garden news,
it hasn't rained for over a day and a half, so I think I could walk in the garden without it falling apart. We're looking to redo the greenhouse. I think we built it like 4 or 5 years ago, and so the plastic has reached the end of its life. So we're going to get some new greenhouse plastic, and then we can start some seedlings. We're really, I think, going to focus on greens a lot this year. All right, time for thanks. Thanks to Will Ridenour for allowing me to use his beautiful song, Sabali Dawn, The Dance of Peace. You can find more of Will's music at his website, willridenour.com. And of course, thanks to all of you Plant Yourself Podcast patrons. Kim Harrison, Lynn McClellan, Brittany Porter, Dominic Maurer, Barbara Whitney, Tammy Black, Amy Good, Amanda Hatherley, Mary Jane Wheeler, Ellen Kennelly, Melissa Cobb, Rachel Behrens, Tina Scharf, Tina Ahern, Jen Filikanovsky, David Bizek, The Mysterious Michelle X, Elsbeth Feldman, Leia Stoller, Alan Christensen, Colleen Peck, Michelle Landry, Josina, Sarah Durkas, Kelly Cameron, Janet Selby, Claire Adams, Tom Franza, Jeanette Benham, Gil Assert, David Donahue, Blair Cyber, Dorona Vizov, Gio and Carolyn Argentati, Jody Friesner, Misha Rosen, Michael Warbeck, Aviva Lael, Alicia Lemus, Val Linneman, Nick Harper, Bandana Chali, Molly Levine, The Inscrutable Harry R., Susan Laverty, The Panda Vegan, Craig Kovic, Adam Scharf, Karen Burry, Heather Morgan, Nigel Davies, Marion Blum, Teresa Koppel, Julian Watkins, Breed O'Connell, Sharon Hirschman, Linda Ayad, Holm Hedegaard, Iza Tuzinwa, Connie Hainline, Aaron Greer, Alicia Davis, Heather O'Connor, Carolyn Jensen, Sherry Lakoski of Plant Power for Health, Karen Smith, Scott Marani, Karen and Joe Crabtree, Kirby Burton, Teresa Carell, Kevin McCauley, Elizabeth Rothschild, Ann Jesse, Cheryl Dwyer, Jenny Hazelton, Peter W. Evans, Dennis Bird, Darby Kelly, Lori Fanny, Linnea Lundquist, Emily Iconelli, Levy Wallach, Rosamund McAtee, Dan Picorni, Stephen Leenan, Patty V. Martino, Mike and Donna Kartz, Deanne Bishop, Bilberry Elf, Marjorie Lewis, Trisha Adams, Nancy Sheldon, Lindsay Bayshore, Gunmarit Hagen, Tracy Gullidge, Laura Heaton, Meg from Mama Says, Stacey Stokes, Ben Savage, Michael Kay, David Hughes, Connie Rogers, Claire England, Sally Robertson, Paranganchi, Amy Daly, Brian Tourville, Mark Jeffrey Johnson, Josie Dempsey, Karen Schmidt, Pamela Hayden, Emily Perryman, Allison Corbett, Richard Stone, Lauren Vaught of Edible Musings, Aaron Hasty, Sean Owen, Sagar Nayak, Erica Piedra, Danielle Roberts, Michael Lushton, Sarah Johnson, Catherine Floyd, for your generous support of the podcast. That's it for now. As always, be well, my friends.